Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. We are so excited to be joined this morning by Dr. Sophie Richter-Devereaux, who is an associate professor in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences and in the Middle Eastern Studies Department at Hamad bin Khalifa University. Dr. Richter-Devereaux, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, and we are really excited to start this discussion of women's political activism in Palestine, Peace Building, Resistance, and Survival, which was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2018. So we can just probably get right into a discussion of the book because, as I said before we started recording, I am so excited to hear more about your the fieldwork that went into this and your sort of theoretical contributions. But the first sort of general question that I have for you is if you could talk maybe a little bit about how the project was conceived and how you came to approach questions of women's political activism through the lens of the everyday.
Yeah, thank you so much for this great question. So I started this project in 2007. Well, I started thinking about it from, of course, earlier onwards, but I started in 2007. And, you know, at that time, there was a lot of discussion globally about the Women, Peace and Security agenda, the UN Resolution 1325 that calls for increased participation of women in peace building, conflict resolution. And I was interested like my very early question was simply an interest to see what does this global agenda mean for a local context such as Palestine, a local context dominated by settler colonization, by statelessness, and of course prolonged violence. Now, with this initial question started a long process of fieldwork, my time on the ground in Palestine really taught me quite early on that in a way I'm asking maybe a good entry question, but not the right question to understand political activism in Palestine. Because very clearly this kind of women, peace and security agenda and the focus on peace building, particularly joint peace building between Palestinian and Israeli women, had very little to do with the realities on the ground. It received a lot of media attention, but that's not what women were doing on the ground. So then my project really started trying to go beyond these stereotypical representations of Palestinian women, either as some kind of peace builders that reach out to the other side or resistance fighters, armed resistors like Laila Khaled, or the victims of violence. I wanted to look beyond this stereotypical representation and really see what are women doing? What does it mean to do politics in a context such as Palestine, dominated by settler colonization, prolonged settler state violence, and statelessness? And how can we capture these forms of politics also conceptually? And then, I mean, to come to your second question, this really meant then that one that I had to move from the classic understandings of what is the political, what is political activism, I had to move further and I had to look at the everyday. And I had to look how I had to study and try to understand better how women are coping on an everyday level and how their everyday survival and coping strategies are in fact part and parcel and an integral part of the political.
Definitely. And I hope that we can come back and sort of really delve into this concept of the everyday. But before we sort of talk a bit more about the theoretical contributions of the text, you mentioned something quite interesting and something that I think is sort of part and parcel of ethnographic fieldwork, at least, which is that you have one set of questions and you sort of go to start your fieldwork in a particular field site and realize that those questions actually aren't the ones that are sort of relevant or aren't the ones that are kind of on the minds of the individuals that you are working with. And so I wonder if you could maybe talk a bit about the methodological choices that informed your analysis and maybe how those choices contributed to your own understanding of the methods that women utilize in their own resistance efforts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. So, this is predominantly an ethnographic project where I spent around 11 months between 2007 and 2009 in the West Bank mainly. I also was a lot in East Jerusalem and I spent a few days in Gaza. Since this time, since 2009, I've been going regularly back to Palestine. So in a way, also these other visits to Palestine inform my analysis in the book. But the actual fieldwork for the book took place between 2007 and 2009. So this being an ethnographic project, I tried to spend as much time as possible with people on the ground. I lived with families in different areas of the West Bank, in different municipalities, and shared their everyday life. So much of my field work really took place in kitchens, on the fields. There were some more official interviews. I conducted more than 84 interviews, more formal interviews. I mean, you know, scheduled with a recorder, etc. These interviews were largely with women activists who had played crucial roles in the first intifada. So these were women who had a long history of involvement in the more public, overt forms of activism. But then after Oslo had moved into other forms of engaging, for example, in NGOs, or indeed had maybe retreated from this kind of public politics. So I found it very important to start with these memories and narratives of these very experienced female activists. But then I also did a lot of informal conversations and other interviews with just ordinary people who nevertheless conceived of their own activities, and I analyzed their own activities as forms of political activism. Those that participate in demonstration and protests against the wall, that was a very important form of activism at the time, protests against the illegal apartheid wall. But also people who were just trying to keep their family together and trying to establish some kind of normal life. So additionally to these interviews and these ethnographic observations in people's everyday life, I also participated in political activities such as, for example, protests and demonstrations, but also meetings. I attended several meetings between Palestinian and Israeli activists to understand a bit better this people-to-people and women's peace activism. So really, to cut the long story short, I tried to diversify my methods, but they were very much grounded in an ethnographic approach of trying to understand how people in their everyday life really perceive of the political and how they navigate through these various political, economical, cultural structures that are constraining their agency.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that sort of sense of your own experiences of living life with the individuals that you were sort of working with, I'm sure brings a different texture of understanding to what you conceive of as everyday life and the ways in which, you know, as you put in the book, an ever-tightening Israeli occupation and settler colonial policies actually contribute to the forms of political activism and resistance that are utilized by the women that you were working with. Well, thank you so much. I guess now if we could sort of delve into some of the main theoretical contributions of the text, and certainly one that seemed to be perhaps the main takeaway from the book, or at least one of the most significant, was your contention that women confront settler colonialism both directly and indirectly through variable acts of resistance. And of course, you position that in contrast to classical political analysis or liberal notions of the political, as perhaps discussed most, you know, famously by Habermas and his understanding of a singular uniform public sphere. And as well as assumptions of women as, you know, fundamental peacemakers. And I wonder if you could maybe speak a bit broadly about how you came to that conclusion and how it serves to enhance studies of gender and politics in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you already in your question brought the two issues together. You brought together on the one hand women's peacemaking activities and initiatives and the Habermasian theorization of the public sphere. So, I mean, broadly speaking, the book is a critique of this of the Habermasian conceptualization of the public sphere as homogeneous, as unitary, as a space between so-called state and market, where private people come together to rationally discuss and deliberate on questions of the public or common good, rather than conceiving of the political or the public sphere as such. I rely on feminist theorists such as Nancy Fraser, who have shown that not only is this understanding historically not valid, because there were always women's counter publics or women's ways of engaging in the public sphere that were different from this hegemonic, homogeneous notion of the public sphere that Habermas describes. So not only is it historically not correct, but also Nancy Fraser very importantly tells us maybe it should not be that way, right? Maybe we should be interested rather in having multiple and contestatory counter-publics, subaltern counter-publics, as she calls this. So with this kind of theoretical background in mind, I first started to look at the women-to-women peace-building initiatives. And here, of course, the idea, the underlying idea of these projects is that when you bring together people from the Palestinian side with people from the Israeli side and you allow them to just talk to each other, then they will find ways to bond, overcome the national divide, maybe particular gender issues will bring them together closely. So here we see some basics of the Habermasian idea on ideal speech and deliberation as the core to politics, dialogue as the core to politics. We see it reflected in these dialogue groups. I mean, here the idea is precisely that the ways in which Palestinian women should do politics is by dialoguing with the other side. Now, the empirical evidence shows that these people-to-people projects were quite a big failure. I mean, they not only did they not lead to any tangible results on the ground, I mean, the situation has rather gone much worse. They also have been very problematic for the people involved themselves, who see this as a form of normalization. And society, Palestinian society, more largely sees it as a form of normalization. So, meaning somehow pretending that there's a picture of people can just meet and they can talk and they can dialogue, and the whole violences and asymmetries and inequalities between the two sides moves into the background. Here it's presented like a conflict, you just bring the two sides together, but this is a settler colonial context of one side settler colonizing the other. So this is the failure of the peace of these peace projects. Also shows us that maybe it's not enough to conceive of the political merely or predominantly through the notion of dialogue and discursive deliberation, a la Habermas. Rather, we need to move further. And here, I mean, then along with the theory, I trace the other forms of politics, like, for example, popular resistance. Here it's not about dialoguing with the Israeli side, but rather it's about radically confronting and highlighting, even dramatizing the injustices and inequalities between the two sides. It's not trying to say we are two parts in the conflict. It's clearly starting from a very different starting point, pointing at the inequalities and asymmetries, confronting them and trying to overcome them. Here then, in a way, my book proceeds going through the various forms of activism and letting the women on the ground, I mean, my idea was to let the women on the ground speak back to this Habermasian ideal of the public sphere and highlight, with of course the backing of the very strong feminist scholarship on these ideas, highlighting that it is not enough to understand to conceive the public sphere in the Habermasian way. Now, how does, I think you also asked, how does this sit it's with the of,
yeah yes sort of broadly enhance maybe studies of gender and politics in the Middle East?
Yeah, exactly, because for now I spoke more about how it relates to the theory. If we look at the literature on women's politics or women's political activism in the Middle East, there is, of course, a very important body of literature. There is the classic anthologies by scholars such as Leila Abulurut, Denise Candioti, Nikki Caddy, etc., that interrogated the politics of modernity and tried to show how modernity is always enabling, but also a restricting force. This also showed how the state plays an important role in shaping women's activism, often through state feminisms, etc. So this literature is very important because it debunks all the Orientalist discourses on women in the Middle East being passive or Muslim women being the oppressed other, etc. It's a very important body of literature that I always went back to. But in a way, I wanted to look more specifically on this question: what does it mean to do politics in the context of Palestine? And indeed, there is quite also some literature that deals more specifically with women's political activism in the Middle East. Very often, I think this literature focuses more on women's involvement in protests and demonstrations. We've seen a rise now since the Arab revolutions, a lot of focus on how women are participating in these revolutions, how gender and political issues are intertwined. This is also very important literature because it shows that historically and today, women always played an important role in politics in the Middle East. It's not something exceptional, as maybe some Western media representations might put it more. But overall, I think there's very little that focuses specifically on the everyday. I mean, it is more generally situated within the classic conceptualization of, women's participation in political parties, protest politics, in NGOs, civil society, etc. But not really looking at what does it mean to try and keep a family or a society together. Is this a form of political activism? Is the everyday also a place of the political? So here I hope my book can make the contribution.
No, definitely. I think it certainly does. And I think in just hearing you speak about it, you raise a number of important points. I know something that you talk about towards the end of the book and in the conclusion is the idea certainly developed by Laila Abu-Lughod, which is, you know, the effort to not romanticize forms of resistance, but truly to just, you know, explore the textures of different forms of women's resistances, and then to also show, you know, in her classic inversion of Foucault's notion of where there's power, there's resistance. Well, where there's resistance, there's power. And I think in your exploration throughout the text, it does a very good job of, you know, constantly exploring the ways that those two things parallel one another, and to never forget, as you mentioned earlier, the kind of context in which all of this is situated. And that is, of course, one characterized by intensified Israeli occupation and settler colonial policies, which often actively prevent political activism, and certainly that of women's political activism more specifically. And then something else that I was curious about talking a little bit more in detail is the idea of the sort of almost failure of the women-to-women dialogue, and how, to me, that read as being, you know, in line very much with other anthropological and feminist critiques of sort of women's empowerment programs. And of course, the suggestion that's often made by feminist scholars is that discourses of empowerment, particularly those in the colonial world, have become closely tied to neoliberal technologies of governance. And so there's, you know, a kind of failure of those women's empowerment programs. And I wonder if, you know, you saw that as being kind of a correct reading, or if you see your work intersecting at all with those broader critiques of development, of international programs and peace talks, and something like the UNSCR, as well as women's empowerment.
Yeah, yes, definitely. I mean, there's certainly an overlap or a lot of space for comparison between the people-to-people projects or the women-to-women project in the context of Palestine, and the broader gender and development agenda of women's empowerment, gender mainstreaming, be it through the UN Resolution 1325 or other such mechanisms. The women-to-women projects in Palestine, of course, have also a particular context. And this is the 1993 Oslo Accords, which policymakers wanted to accompany these peace management from the top with some kind of bottom-up peace building, where people should be brought together and overcome the divides, the national divides, and a lot of focus was put specifically on bringing women together. And there was quite a strong donor interest in that, so quite a lot of funding went into such projects. International women's activists were involved from different European countries, and the idea here was that since these are groups of women, they have maybe something to unite and find ways to overcome the national political divides. And often this was then, so to go back to your question of empowerment and development, this was then presented as a win-win solution on two levels. It would not only advance peace, the narrative goes, but it would also lead to women's empowerment. Now, my conclusion after having spoken to very many women activists who were involved in these early initiatives is that there was no empowerment at all for women's activists in Palestine. In fact, it was a disciplining of their activism, because now international funding and also national policies pushed women into this kind of what was presented as valuable activism, as activism that would advance not only peace, but also women's struggles. And all other forms of activism, the very strong popular resistance that women had been so prominent in during the first Intifada, or indeed everyday forms of activism. All of this was presented as somehow out of line, deviant, and therefore not the good politics. This meant that, in fact, many, many women were pushed out of the political. The only ways in which they could participate was in a women-to-women project, which for many of them was a form of normalization. So what happened here, and what happened here is that a few female activists who became kind of the leaders and international representatives of Palestinian women in joint programs, maybe they indeed were empowered, if we want to use that word, because they indeed, they flew to international conferences. They were always, they were given a lot of space to give their analysis, etc. But many others were disempowered, were in fact left out, were disciplined. And I would therefore say that we have to be very careful here with this, just as the critical literature and development and gender has shown, we have to be very careful with this liberal notion of agency and empowerment. In the Palestinian context, I just want to mention, in the Palestinian context, there has been quite a lot of excellent writing on the development and humanitarian industry, including the peace industry more broadly, that has also shown that after Oslo, much of women's activism, which was more social movement kind of activism, popular resistance, quite very mass-based, was disciplined and fragmented into NGO work rather than NGO activism. So that also was a form of disciplining and disempowering the mass base of women's activism, because now you needed to be an entrepreneur in an NGO with a project plan and an agenda. You needed to speak the lingua of the international development and peace industry, etc. And the Women to Women projects are part and parcel of this wider NGOization, as Islah Jad calls it, of Palestinian civil society.
Oh, certainly, and that rings very true of the sort of women's activism and women's organizational work that I spend some time researching in Jordan, and that my own dissertation is based on, is definitely the idea of how much international funding and the sort of structure of organizational work now, exactly as you said, fragments and divides and sort of lessens maybe the politicized impact of the work that these organizations are able to do, because it's so much hemmed in by the framework of applying for funding, obtaining funding, and sort of working within that model. Exactly. And definitely, I think, disenfranchises maybe some of the earlier political work that we could point to in Jordan or in Palestine that has much more of a, as you sort of discuss in chapter two, maybe a more popular resistance base in history to that as well, certainly. Well, then I think now if we could move into maybe what I read as perhaps the most important theoretical contribution of the text, and one that's definitely fundamental to your analysis of women's political resistance, is of course the intervention that you make about studying the everyday as essential to women's political existence and sort of lived existence in general. And I was hoping that you could kind of expand on this notion of the everyday, although you have touched on it a little bit in our conversation so far, but how it's related to, you know, a shift in women's political activism and resistance from exactly as we talked about, the women to women, more internationally focused work, to political or to popular resistance, and then to this sort of more everyday forms of resistance.
Yeah. So this is, of course, a very wide topic. So let me try and be concise. One term that is used very broadly in Palestinian everyday talk, but also in political culture, is the notion of sumut. Now, sumut literally would translate as steadfastness or one can also, I think, translate it as resilience or indeed everyday resistance. The interesting point is that Somut, of course, has always been part of the Palestinian lexicon on the political. It has undergone various changes in what it means. But so I talk more about this in the book, but I'm not going to talk about it here now. The important thing is that today, Somut kind of describes the steadfast and stubborn insistence to carry on with normal life, maybe even trying to seize opportunities to enjoy this life as much as possible, and despite all the infringements and violations through settler colonization at both the material and the more mental or ideational level. So Somut is in a way the everyday politics that takes place in ordinary life. It's non-organized, it's often individual, it's not collective in the sense like the First Intifada, collective activism and social movements were. This was a notion that people very often brought up when they talked about their everyday life. And they brought it up in different contexts or with different meanings. One relates a lot to the land. Somut means staying on the land. There is a clear connection of being steadfast on the land, not giving in to settler colonization and emigrating. But there's also other ways of conceiving of Somut. There's also the idea that Somut means maintaining and keeping alive Palestinian identities, oral histories and memories, even songs and cultural practices, and more generally, simply trying to keep together the social fabric of the community. As I said, trying to kind of create a normal life despite the abnormal situation. And this, of course, I mean, to repeat a little bit, but this, of course, is not often considered in classic political analysis, especially not in disciplines like political science. This would be considered apolitical, nothing to do with politics. But my contention and my argument in the book is that because Israeli settler colonization takes place not only at the level of the land, of course, largely at the level of the land, but not only. It also takes place at the level of identities, at the ideational level. It also is interested in colonizing the minds of people. Israeli colonization is also about eradicating indigeneity and reforming, reshaping the political subjectivities on the ground into basically docile colonial subjects. And here I think the everyday and insisting on maintaining an everyday life, a normal, to the extent that's possible, a normal, enjoyable life, is precisely speaking back to this colonization of the mind. It's precisely trying to maintain alternative spaces of who we are and who we want to be and who I want my children to be. And that, I think, in the context of Israeli settler colonialism, is a form of political activism, is political as such.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you do that so beautifully, in particular, I mean, throughout the book, but in particular in chapter 3, of, you know, detailing the experiences of individual women as, you know, their individual efforts to sort of, as you said, reclaim life, and the ways in which in the context of Palestine and amidst, you know, Israeli occupation and settler colonialism, how that becomes a political act is just to live a life. And as I said, I think it's so beautiful the way that you lay that out in the third chapter, where you have, you know, included the stories of these individual women and how their acts to just, yes, reclaim a life or live a life has become one that is a political act in this particular context. Well, then the only sort of, I mean, I think that you did a beautiful job outlining the sort of primary theoretical contributions of the text. And so the last question that I have is more about the conclusion and the forward way in which the book sort of looks to call on scholars in future research. And so, and you can correct me if this is perhaps not the correct reading, but it almost, the text ends on an almost hopeful note by saying that women's insistence on their right to have a joyful, normal life constitutes a way for them to fight the existing system, the status quo, by reclaiming their humanity. That is, it offers a way for the, quote, stateless, those without the right to rights, do and understand politics, end quote. And as I said, it formally ends with a call to scholars to further engage in research on women's political resistance in Palestine. And I wonder, since finishing the book, but as you said, since going back and forth to Palestine, since doing the primary fieldwork for this text, and then since the book was published, I wonder if you have begun a new research project, or how maybe you see the future of gendered political research in this particular context.
Yeah, that's a big question, but an important one. I'll try to answer if I can. Maybe I'll start with what I've concluded for myself and how my own research has evolved, and then I'll try to make a broader note. So after having done this project on Palestinian women's activism in the West Bank, and especially focusing on their everyday politics, as we just discussed, I moved to a new project in the Naqab, which is it's in today's southern Israel, next to Gaza, and there's a Palestinian Bedouin population that has received very little scholarship. I mean, there has been the scholarship that has been done on this community, on the Palestinian Bedouin, has been largely done by Israeli anthropologists, or indeed also military advisors, etc. So I had the chance to do field work in that community, and I was working specifically on the oral histories of Naqab Bedouin women. Not only on the oral histories, but indeed on their memories and embodied memories. So overall, I think studying this community, that is a community that has lived inside Israel, formerly many of them with Israeli citizenship, has in a way taught me even more to look at the hidden or the everyday forms of politics, because in this community, a community that has been under very harsh Israeli control, surveillance, and violence since 1948. I mean, even before, but it's very clear here that in order to understand how women there do politics, we cannot look at them going to protests or joining political parties. Indeed, sometimes the political here might be simply in a song that tells something about rereading the history of 1948, or it might be in a photograph that in some small memorabilia that women maintain in order to conserve or remember another history, and through their own memories, through their own indigenous memories, rather than accepting the settler colonial narrative that is so harshly imposed on them, and that indeed is also so harshly taught to their own children and grandchildren in the Israeli schools. So this research on a community that has been, I would say, lived under settler colonization, that functions slightly different than in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, has shown me that we really need to, first of all, we need ethnographic methods to understand this, but also that we really need to look at the everyday and value these memories, these songs, these stories, this embodied presence, simply the ways in which you can see a Bedouin woman sit or occupy her space is a way to read history and to counter the settler colonial narrative. So really, it has taken me much more into the everyday from now on. This will be much more my focus in research. Now, what does it mean for the scholarship on women's activism in the Middle East and on Palestine? As you rightly say, I end the book drawing on Hannah Arendt's notion of the right to have rights, where she states that the stateless not only have lost their rights, but also their right to have rights, and as such have been expelled from humanity. Here, then, these everyday forms of trying to enjoy and create a normal life by Palestinian women, I argue, is also a way to reclaim humanity and to reclaim their dignity and humanity in a context where they're constantly being pushed out of humanity. These notions of dignity, human dignity, and people's struggles to form a political subjectivity that allows them to live a dignified life, that is a very important field to do further research on, because it happens very differently for different generations and in different contexts. But it is a core claim and a core demand that Palestinians from all walks of life are expressing. There's, of course, the broader national struggle, which is an important framework for identity and for political activism. But then there's also that level of humanity and of human dignity, which also provides a framework, a discursive framework for action and for forming subjectivities that is very important for people's political and everyday lives. I mean, the two being overlapped, the political and the everyday. So I think this entry point to the political, human dignity and humanity as a core to political subjectivity is a very, I think that is a very interesting starting point, at least for me, to try and understand political dynamics in Palestine and indeed in the Middle East more broadly, because we have seen similar demands in the Arab revolutions where notions of karama and dignity were also very much mobilized by people. This is all outside of the classic national frames, of the classic national liberation movements or national struggles. People are expressing their politics in different ways, and the notion of dignity and humanity, being part of humanity, is very important here, I think.
Certainly, and it has definitely given me a lot to think about as I start to write my own dissertation, and certainly will give a lot to the listeners of this podcast, a lot of food for thought. So thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and speak with us today about your book, Women's Political Activism in Palestine, Peacebuilding, Resistance, and Survival, again published by the Illinois University Press in 2018. Dr. Richter Devereaux, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure. Really great speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.